Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in that original form. You're tuned into The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics, government, and selfishness went wrong, and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of insight aimed at making each of us more responsible, more cooperative, and more aware of the spiritual bonds that connect us to each other, no matter what insanely silly, stupid, and inane things we find to squabble over. Now, you can call us toll-free from the United States to 877-876-5227. You can call from Canada to 888-810-8322, or you can call direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if one of those really antiquated, old-fashioned, on-the-air stations in your area carries this show, just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for the show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as soon as is humanly or extra-humanly possible on the station archives now. My own blog is located at howtheneoconsstolefreedom.blogspot.com. My blog this week was Blackstone Group Limited Partnership, Your Piece of the Sinking Rock. It evidently caused quite a stir. It came out on Sunday, July 8th, as a blog and was then published in various places, including as my column in The Iconoclast. Now, The Iconoclast is read religiously by a big chunk of those in Washington, D.C., because they're always interested in finding out what's going on. And it was also published on Online Journal. Now, the Iconoclast publishes on Monday, usually, so this article hit D.C. and that readership on Tuesday, July 10th. Now, it takes about 24 hours for the impact of movement in the market to register. On July 11th, you see a severe dip in Blackstone's profile. Take a look if you have time. That same day, Mad Money guru Jim Cramer did a show that made all the same points found in my article. Life's full of amazing coincidences, isn't it? I got a lot of comment. My next article will fill the many requests I received for advice on how to keep money safe. Money comes in three varieties. You have mad money, money that is being risked stupidly, glad money, money that is being handled carefully, and sad money, money that has been lost to one who actually created the value it represents. Each of these kinds of money plays a role in the drama presently being acted out, not just in finance, but in every conceivable part of our lives. Now, as never before, you had better give some thought to getting off the grids. So stay tuned and look for the next segment in the ongoing story on my blog and elsewhere across the world. Now, as to what's been happening this week in presidential politics, United Republicans of California, founded in 1963, endorsed Ron Paul for president. They are now preparing to do the same thing they did for Barry Goldwater, get him the Republican nomination. They will have help. At the same time, it is rumored that several presidential candidates are worried today because their phone numbers are in the records of the D.C. madam now being perused by investigators. One of these is reportedly a not-yet-declared Republican candidate whose initials are FT, just so you know. And our thought for the week ahead. Peace, a cessation of conflict. The first part of the phrase, on earth and goodwill toward men. A state of human existence for which we hunger mightily today at home as well as abroad. Peace is something we need that actually evokes an economic good, though most of us do not associate economics with the word. Peace allows us as a people and as individuals to invest more heavily in long-term projects of all kinds. With peace comes prosperity. What you cannot afford if you do not have enough calories to stretch to the end of the week, you can afford if you have supplies to last through the winter. Peace is not an absence of all conflict. peace is a positive, dynamic condition where conflict is handled in ways that reduces the cost to those who disagree. Peace rejects violence as a solution, allowing us to feel confidence that issues will be resolved in ways that are just. Peace and justice are partners becoming together, peace enacted. At the same time, peace enacted makes it possible for each of us to see each other differently. Instead of meeting in fear, we can meet with confidence. We can anticipate just outcomes. We look forward to meeting others as a means of enriching our own lives. Peace is a good thing. Enabling peace throughout the world is something we have talked about before, from the Crawford Peace House to the Raging Grannies and the Warrior Grannies, to helping people come together as one and so carrying out the mission statement left us by Christ. In each case, where conflict exists, we hunger for peace enabled. Peace enabled rests on a foundation of dispassionate truth so that the process can begin. Our guest today will give us insight so we can start building in just that direction. Know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Alison Weir is committed to the vision of an America that champions peace, living peace with others, and so creating a future that can assume both peace and prosperity as a fact of life. To accomplish that goal, we need to understand the history of conflict in the Middle East and move forward to an agenda that finds solutions to ongoing conflict, identifying the wrongs done and providing justice that heals the wounds of that conflict. That process begins with the truth, rejecting the mythologies and rationalizations used to justify generations of reactive behavior that has impacted uncounted millions of lives. Today, Palestine is occupied territory. So is America, as long as we, the people, do not have the truth that enables us to take action that heals the breaches of trust that now divide us one from another across all lines. In 2004, Ms. Weir was inducted into honorary membership of Phi Alpha Literary Society, founded in 1845 at Illinois College. The award cited her as a courageous journalist lecturer on behalf of human rights, the first woman to receive an honorary membership in Phi Alpha history. Ms. Weir presents a powerful, well-documented view of the Middle East today. She's intelligent, careful, and critical. American policymakers would benefit greatly from hearing her first-hand observations and attempting to answer the questions she poses. This is an intellectual, thought-provoking, and worthwhile presentation. And this was by Thomas Campbell, former U.S. Senator, Dean of Haas School of Business, University of California, Director, California Department of Finance. Allison established a website, If Americans Knew, to keep Americans informed on breaking events. The Americans face a lot of problems today that Alice can help you understand. One of those is why the mainstream media is failing to give Americans the truth about Israel and Palestine. Another is how U.S. foreign aid to Israel is killing innocent people and enabling a train of circumstance that could lead to world war. People are profiting today from genocide. But there are ways that we can exit from the grid of violence that now doom our children to ever more lies and violence. And that is the question that will be at the core of our show today. And Allison is here to help us find and explore those answers. So please welcome Allison Weir. Allison, are you there?
I am here. Thank you very much.
And thank you so much for being with us. Now, we always begin by asking our guests to tell us something about themselves. So tell us something about Allison when she's not doing what Allison does.
Well, I'm certainly doing something I would never have predicted about 9 years ago. Really, like most Americans, I never was very focused on Israel-Palestine, and therefore I really knew very little about it. My background is in journalism. I've raised three children that I happen to think are wonderful human beings, and that's been a lot of the focus of my life. It was only back in about fall of 2000 when the current Palestinian uprising began and I became curious about the subject and started to look into it for myself that I had no idea what a change my life would take just from asking a few of those questions. And that's what's brought me here to you today.
So you ask the question, and one question is, it isn't like it's going to answer the question and there aren't any other questions. It just starts a whole chain of questions.
That's
what happened.
That's right. I just, at that point, I was the editor of a small newspaper in Sausalito, California, a very local journalism where you're writing about the city council, the school district, the fishing fleet, that kind of thing. But I was curious about, you know, about this uprising in which we were seeing those images of unarmed civilians, many children throwing stones against tanks. And, of course, you know, that seems like extremely foolish, very dangerous behavior. Why in the world would a population do that? So I began following the news coverage just more carefully than I had, not, you know, not for my professional needs because I was a local journalist, but just out of curiosity. But as a journalist, when I did that, I noticed that the coverage I was reading pretty much everywhere, the San Francisco Chronicle, the New York Times, I listened to NPR quite a bit, National Public Radio, and it was very clear that I was getting Israeli-centric reporting, that that's the perspective I was getting. And since I wanted the whole information, I didn't really want, and I don't want, bias in any direction, I just wanted all of the information, that got me more curious to see, well, what is the other half to this? And starting to use the Internet, I looked into it more and more just on my own in all of my spare time, became so outraged and saddened and astonished at what I found that after several months I just quit my job as the editor of the Sausalito newspaper and went over as a freelance reporter traveling around Gaza and the West Bank in February and March of 2001 by myself as a freelance reporter to see what was going on. And it was such an extremely intense experience. I saw enormous devastation. If you go to a hospital, you see Palestinian children that have been shot, many of them. You see children with bullets in their backs quite often, sometimes in their heads, serious injuries. Of course, many have been killed. And I realized that really almost none of that was being reported to the American public. So when I returned from that trip, I decided that Americans needed to know the facts on this issue. We need to know about lots of things. But given the fact that American tax money to Israel is funding Israeli actions, I felt it was especially essential that we be informed on this topic because we're playing a major role in it, and almost none of us are aware of that. I certainly never was before.
So here you noticed that America was playing a major role in the outcome of, you know, horrible violence.
That's right.
In another part of the world, without, and Americans are simply going about their business completely oblivious to the fact that that's going on. But in any sense of moral theory, they're accountable for that. And in terms of what we've seen with blowback, with anger and rage directed at the United States, you know, Americans are bewildered. They don't understand why those people hate us. And they're buying these lines of rhetoric about why people are angry with us from other parts of the world, and they simply aren't true, and they need to know why.
That's right. To me, I feel and felt then, and the more I've learned about this issue, the more I've studied it, and that's really what I've done for the last, I guess, 7 or 8 years, is studied this intensely, the more concerned I am, both because the Americans' lack of knowledge on this issue, of course, is extremely destructive for the region itself, but it's also very dangerous for us. I have family here, as I mentioned. I want my family to be safe, as well as everyone around the world, and yet I'm now very aware that the policies being adopted by our government, and this isn't just the current administration, this has been going on for many decades, sadly, extremely harmful to the United States as well. And therefore, I feel a profound obligation to tell Americans these facts. To me, this is not a political issue. It's not a matter of Democrats versus Republicans or Libertarians versus Greens. This is a matter of the American citizens across the board need to be accurately and fully informed on this topic without bias. And that's not the situation today. our media are giving us very Israeli-centric reporting, at least, sometimes even worse than that.
Mm-hmm. And all of those issues are reflected very, very strongly in your website, which is, you know, If Americans Knew. Right?
Well, that's right. It's ifamericansknew.org, and that's our goal, is to give, to the best of our ability and very limited resources, the information that we're not getting from the media that we should be getting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are citizens of, at the current point in time, this is the most powerful nation on earth. It is a democracy, which means we have a great deal of power when we choose to exercise it through our voting and other ways. And therefore, we need to get the full information. And on our website, we're giving much of the information that we should be getting from the media and are not.
Mm-hmm.
We also have done a number of media studies of the New York Times, of the primetime television networks, document the coverage that we're getting. We analyze it statistically, and we provide the evidence for what I'm saying here. Anybody should believe something just because I say it or someone else says it.
Well, that's the thing about your site. It really provides the documentation.
Thank you, because that's certainly what we're trying to do, and I feel we're doing it. We do get a lot of very positive feedback from people thanking us for information they had not known about before.
Mm-hmm. And that's what's happening, of course, with the issue with the media. The media isn't giving us the information, and therefore Americans don't know. What the information they do get is highly biased toward the Zionist viewpoint.
That's right.
And you on your site, you do an analysis of the kind of reporting that's going on.
That's right. And I think the problem is that most of the problem with the U.S. media reporting is that a great many extremely newsworthy events are just not being reported to us. And therefore, you know, it's the case of lying through omission. That's the most dangerous and most effective kind of falsification, because even if you're highly intelligent and skeptical and you read carefully, you don't know what's being left out unless you're studying this for yourself, unless you go to the reports that are coming out of the region itself, both from within Israel and from within the Palestinian territories. If you don't do that, then you don't know what is not being reported to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the major bulk of the information. It's sort of like a, you know, the old thing about an iceberg, right? What is it? I think it's 90% or 3/4 of something is below the water.
Right.
Most of the information on this topic we're not even getting.
Mm-hmm.
So the questions we're asking about the current affairs are often not even the questions we would be asking if we were getting all of the information.
Mm-hmm. And since 9/11, one of the things that's happened is that the way that Palestinians or Arabs, all Arabs, are portrayed to us is so negative.
That's right.
That they almost become subhuman.
That's right. Well, and intelligent people with good principles are drawing what seem to them logical conclusions, because they're drawing their conclusions based on the information they're getting. But they don't know if they're getting the full picture, their conclusions would be very different. I often liken it to one of those dot-to-dot pictures that children have where you learn your numbers by connecting 1 to 2 to 3 to 4, etc.
Right.
And, you know, when you do it correctly, at the end you have a picture of a star,
mm-hmm.
or maybe a car. Well, let's say that you were missing 3/4, at least, of all of the dots. The picture that would emerge would either make no sense, or it might be a totally different object
mm-hmm.
than the real picture, because the dots are missing. And that's how it is for the American public.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think as what had gotten your attention recently, probably in terms of our own work, was the article I just did about USA Today and media coverage of the Israeli attack on a U.S. Navy ship, the USS Liberty.
Absolutely. That is something I think that's really caught a lot of the people's attention. And they're shocked when they find out that this is something that actually happened in the 60s.
That's right. I was one of those that was shocked. I had never known about it. I grew up in a military family. My father was a military officer. My uncle was an officer in the Navy, another one in the Army. You know, I was in that kind of environment, and yet I had never been aware that Israel had attacked and had tried to sink a U.S. Navy ship in a
mm-hmm.
very in a prolonged and quite brutal attack.
It was prolonged and brutal, and they used many different kinds of weapons.
That's
right.
So
it had the attack went through several different layers of attack too.
That's right. I wonder, shall I just give a sort of brief synopsis?
Give a synopsis of exactly what happened in that day.
Okay, I'll be glad to do that, and then maybe we can get into the current aspect of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
What this is in 1967, during the Six-Day War, Israeli forces attacked a U.S. Navy ship called the USS Liberty. The Liberty was called an electronic ship. What it was a surveillance ship. It had antennas sticking out everywhere to pick up transmissions from the whole area. It's sometimes called a spy ship, but it wasn't stealthy. It was very obvious what it was, and it was, you know, the ship was listed in Jane's book of Navy ships, for example, around the world. It was very easily identified as an American ship and what it was.
Mm-hmm.
So the Liberty was there offshore in international waters on June 8, 1967. It was not in the combat zone. Off-duty sailors were out when they were not on duty, were out sunbathing on decks, fishing, etc., because they were just there sitting and moving along in the water at a slow speed with the American flag fully furled out behind as they were steaming across the water. Some Israeli Air Force aircraft came and circled the ship several times. The sailors looked up, saw that it was the Israeli Air Force, were not worried since this was our good ally, sort of waved to the pilots. They were close enough. They could see the pilots' faces. They were surveilled a few times in the morning. The sailors were relieved. Oh, good, you know, we're safe. This is Israel, our ally.
So, I mean, this was a multiple thing. It happened more than once. They looked, very carefully identified the ship.
Very carefully identified the ship. Then a few hours later, suddenly there were aircraft that suddenly attacked the ship. They started shelling it. They napalmed it. They, on their first pass, they knocked out almost all of the antennas. One antenna, fortunately for the crew members and for the rest of us, was not functioning, so they didn't knock out one antenna. Because of that, the crew was able to get out of Mayday, that they were under attack. At that time, they set by unidentified aircraft because the aircraft did not show any insignia. It was only later that it came out that
it was a stealth attack.
It was a stealth attack, intentionally covering up who was doing it. That's very revealing right there.
Mm-hmm.
So they attacked the ship, as I said, with shells, with rocket, with cannon, with napalm. When they killed nine people, I think, right at the beginning there. A number of officers on deck were killed. A number were very, very seriously wounded, including the captain, Captain McGonagall. Then they sent out a torpedo ship. The torpedo boat launched torpedoes from at the ship. One of them hit right amidships. Again, luckily, miraculously, it hit in a part of the ship that had extra structure below, so it didn't tear the ship in half the way it otherwise would have, but it did rip out a 40-foot hole in the ship, killing 25 more Americans with that torpedo.
Mm-hmm.
At one point during all of this, the abandoned ship order was given, and they started to put life rafts over the side to abandon ship, and the Israelis on board the torpedo ship machine-gunned life rafts. This is a war crime. One of the life rafts, in fact, they took on board their own ship. In other words, trying their best to make sure everybody on board the ship would die.
Mm-hmm.
They machine-gunned. There were stretcher bearers. There was, you know, a great deal of massive injury. We know of over 170 sailors were injured. 34 were killed. So the injured were being taken below decks on stretchers. Stretcher bearers were machine gunned also by this Israeli torpedo boat that was very, very close, that was circling the ship.
Mm-hmm.
When they didn't manage to sink it yet, helicopters came, filled with commandos in combat gear who were about to board the ship quite clearly. And at that point, they suddenly withdrew. And a little while later, Israel made the claim that, oh dear, somehow by mistake we attacked your ship. This was, oh, what a terrible mistake. Can we help you, etc.?
Now let's hold there for a second, because I'd like us to consider what happened that changed the outcome there, because very clearly they were intended to kill all of these people. And
that's
there must have been some intervening action that perhaps we've never found out about.
It's hard, you know, a number of excellent researchers, one of the officers on board, Jim Ennis, who's, I believe, a lieutenant commander now retired from the Navy, put much of this together and wrote a book about it. He was, of course, on board the ship. He was very badly injured himself. Over the coming years, he talked to different crew members, interviewed them, got each person's story so that we could put together all of the details about what happened during this attack. Other journalists have looked into this as well to try to figure out what has happened. One thing I should mention, too, is that in the course of all of this, what the crew members on board did not know until later is that there were rescue aircraft from aircraft carriers not too far away that launched aircraft to come to the rescue of the Liberty, and those rescue aircraft were called back by orders from Lyndon Baines Johnson.
So directly from Lyndon Baines Johnson they were ordered back.
That's right. That's right. This is the only time in the history of the United States Navy that rescue aircraft have been called back, especially.
And an American military vessel under attack and
that's
vulnerable.
Right. That's right.
And of course, that would in itself be an act of treason on his part.
That's correct.
Because that's a violation of his oath of office.
That's right. That should have and should still result in congressional investigation into this incident, which has never happened. There has never been a congressional investigation of this attack.
There have been many, many requests for it, however.
Oh, many requests. And there are claims that it has been done, but it has not.
Every time it's been asked for, it's been quashed.
That's right.
Because they simply told these men, many of whom are still alive, the survivors, that they are not permitted to discuss it.
That's right. What happened after the attack is that there was finally order, you know, after the attack was over, the U.S. did finally come to the assistance of the men. They did get the ship back to Malta. There was an inquiry was ordered to be conducted into it, and the people investigating the attack were given 1 week to gather evidence. You know, normally this would be a six-month investigation at least. They were given 1 week to gather evidence.
Mm-hmm.
They gathered evidence. They were then ordered by Robert McNamara, who was the Secretary of Defense. Now, this has all come out within the last few years, that the Secretary of Defense had ordered them to find that it was an accidental attack, that it was, quote, friendly fire, mistaken identity. The Israeli story that is repeated by Israeli advocates in this country as well is that Israel thought that this was an Egyptian ship, an Egyptian horse carrier that carried horses for the cavalry. It's an absurd contention. The ship that they claimed they thought it was is half the length of the Liberty, about one quarter or one fifth the mass of the Liberty, looked completely different, did not have the U.S. identifying insignia on the sides, was not flying the U.S. flag as the Liberty was. The Liberty's flag, the U.S. flag, was shot down once by these Israeli aircraft. They hoisted another flag, especially a large one, the kind that's used during parade, you know, nautical parades. That one was also shot down. But the Israeli claim is that, oh, we thought it was an Egyptian ship, and that's why we attacked it for this prolonged, vicious, brutal attack.
You have to ask yourself why they would attack a horse carrier that way.
That's right. That's
horses are not exactly known for their viciousness.
That's right.
And now, there are usually a minimum number of actual crew members on a horse carrier anyway.
That's right. In addition, there's additional evidence that again has come out in the last 5 to 10 years, which is it turns out that the NSA, the National Security Agency, had aircraft that were also surveilling the area during this attack. Some of them were above the attack while it was going on and were recording the transmissions by the Israeli pilots as they were attacking the ship. And the pilots were saying, wait, there's an American flag. This is an American ship. You know, we shouldn't attack it. They were being ordered by headquarters to continue the attack. This is, again, extremely important information. This has come out from various sources that are very reliable sources. Because of this information that has come out in recent years, some of the information is by Captain Ward Boston, who was the senior counsel to the one-week inquiry I mentioned earlier, a little while ago. He was the senior attorney who was gathering evidence for this inquiry. He has since come out and said, I'm a naval officer for 30 years. I followed orders, and we were ordered to keep this quiet. But he said, now I am going to give the full truth. All of the evidence that we found in investigating this was that it was an intentional attack by the U.S., by the Israeli military on a U.S. Navy ship.
And there has been an intentional cover-up ever since it happened.
An intentional cover-up by order of the White House.
Okay, well, this is horrific enough in and of itself, of course, but let's go on to the implications of what that has for policy, what was going on in Israel at the time.
That's right. Well, Israel at the time was continuing its Pearl Harbor-like attack on its neighbors. Many people don't know that the Six-Day War was initiated by Israel, not the reverse. Many people think Israel was attacked. That's not the case. Israel attacked Egypt, knocked out its air force on the ground, killed many Egyptians right there, attacked Jordan, attacked Syria. It initiated the violence. It used that war to acquire a territory that did not belong to it. It acquired the West Bank and the Golan Heights, which it still has, and which is occupied territory.
Mm-hmm.
Now, during that attack, the fact that it attacked a U.S. Navy ship, let's think about what this would have meant if they had succeeded in sinking the ship. None of us, of course, know why they attacked the ship and tried to sink it. You know, the only people that know that are the Israelis that ordered the attack. But there are conjectures, and one of the things we can do is a thought experiment. Well, if the ship had been sunk, we would have, I think, expected and been told that it was attacked by Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
That was even the crew's expectation. You know, that's why when they saw the Israeli attackers, they thought they were safe. So I believe that we would all know about the USS Liberty today because we would all think that it had been attacked by the Egyptian military, and it would have brought in the U.S. on the side of Israel in this military conflict. And we would have no doubt joined their military actions and would have quite likely attacked Egypt ourselves.
Which would have simply annihilated them.
It would have. It would have been, you know, quite...
Shooting fish in a barrel.
That's right. It's, you know, that type of thing. Now, this may, you know, maybe to some people this sounds like a stretch, but this kind of attempt was made earlier in the early 1950s. In an incident that is widely known in Israel, but again that almost no Americans know about, in something called the Lavon Affair.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I don't think we have the time to go into that, but I encourage people to look into the Lavon Affair.
So could you spell it for people so they can get it?
It's on our website. We have information as well. I believe it's the Lavon Affair.
Okay.
Which the Mossad... tried to make it seem that some attacks against American gathering places would have seemed to have been from the Muslim Brotherhood. It caused a great scandal in Israel at the time, and it caused a change in the Israeli government. It was, you know, it's fully documented and yet very hidden from the American public.
Mm-hmm. So these things happened, and what you're saying is that they happened because they were trying to elicit a sympathetic response in the United States for Israel. Israel could continue an ongoing covert war against its Arab neighbors.
That's right, and its Arab citizens. You know, again, a lot of people don't know that, you know, it's portrayed, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is portrayed as though Palestinians and other Arabs are invading Israel. The fact of the matter is, I know you're aware, but, you know, some people may not be, is that Palestine was there already. Palestinians were living there, and Israel was imposed on the region by a major expulsion of the original citizens that were living on the land, 95% of whom originally were Christian and Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And that they were methodically and forcefully expelled from the land. Those are the Palestinians. So the Palestinians are not trying to invade Israel. They are the indigenous population.
Mm-hmm. And they're treated, they're very, of course, even today, they're treated very badly. As a matter of fact, what's going on there has been characterized as an ongoing slow-motion genocide.
That's right. And that's an accurate description of it. The original expulsion, really, I know that this may sound extreme, but it's not. I use words as precisely as I can. It was ethnic cleansing from the beginning. It was an ethnic cleansing operation, and it continues to be an effort at ethnic cleansing.
Mm-hmm.
This is written about quite well in a book that came out recently by an Israeli author named Ilan Pape, who writes about it with great detail and with full footnoting, where anybody can look into the references to see how accurate his book is, and it's extremely accurate.
And other people, including Christopher Hedges, have reported some extremely horrific and bizarre practices that enable, create justifications for actually shooting Palestinian children.
Oh, yes. I've now visited there a number of times, and anybody that has is just truly shocked at what's going on. It's tragic and cruel, extremely cruel. There is a policy, there has been for many years, where quite often at the various borders, both to the Palestinian territories and to Israel itself, and within the Palestinian territories, where they have been strip-searching children. Young girls get strip-searched just randomly.
Mm-hmm.
Women. I wrote an article about this a while ago. We have a short video that tells about this policy and where you hear directly from the women themselves that I think is very powerful, and I hope some of your listeners may go on our website and view that. We also have a DVD we can send to people
mm-hmm.
with some of this information on it.
And
now, of course, what's especially troubling to me, again, as an American journalist, is that American journalists should be covering this. Some are trying to. Sometimes they're very good reports. But we're not getting the full information. USA Today, which finally, in its 25-year history, finally discovered the attack on the USS Liberty, despite the fact that there have been numerous newsworthy events in the last 5 to 10 years alone that they have never covered. Finally, they wrote one article about it that came out on June 8th. In that article, they printed two completely fraudulent sentences. They are false. They are as untrue as any sentence can be, and yet they refuse to run the correction that journalistic ethics require that they run.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this, of course, goes back to the same issue, doesn't it? We have as a systemic problem in our country the collusion of the media to cover up events that actually occur, and then produce a volume of information in other mediums that are related, for instance, entertainment. I mean, I think we're both aware of what's gone on with shows like 24.
That's right.
That characterize these people as some sort of nutty jihadists.
That's right. It's really a horrible situation and potentially catastrophic because, you know, we keep hearing the phrase clash of civilizations and the war against terror and, you know, and I remember I've been focused on this issue since 2000, fall of 2000. And during this period, when it's sort of like when you're looking at a street corner because you know something's wrong there, and you keep seeing crashes, you know, and you're seeing them firsthand because you happen to be looking there. Everybody else is looking in lots of different directions, and they're maybe missing it, looking at it afterwards. So I've been following this particular subject matter during this period, just by accident, of getting curious back, you know, in 2000. And it's terrible to watch. I see massive manipulation. I see a very dangerous pattern developing. Fortunately, some people are seeing through it, are smart enough to think, oh, wait a minute, you know, I don't trust that. I don't think a whole population is totally different than we are. We're all human beings. So fortunately, a lot of Americans bring healthy skepticism to it. But,
you know, not many enough.
Not enough. Many are taken in by it. The media across the board are bad, but some are far worse than others. And it's a very, very dangerous situation. We need to be informed on it, and we need to inform our neighbors about it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And on top of that, one of the other things that seems to be going on here is the acting out. People assume, I mean, the State of Israel, they see it as a religious, you know, a religious institution, and they see this as a religious war. But that's not really the case, because Zionism, which was the impulse, it's a political philosophy that caused Israel to come into existence. Isn't that right?
That's right. That's exactly correct. And what happens is, because Zionism, which is a political ideology, a very, you know, it's a fanatic ideology, truthfully, and it's confused people, because Israel was created as the Jewish state. That's how it's identified and how it identifies itself. Many mainstream Jewish organizations support it. I think this is a great mistake. Many major Jewish individuals are very critical and have spoken critical of it for many years. When Zionism was first instituted, it was considered, and by many observant Jewish Americans and Jewish Israelis, it's still considered very heretical. It does not follow the tenets of Judaism itself. One of the best writers on this was really a man named Alfred Lilienthal, who happily is still alive today. I've had the honor of interviewing him. But he, you know, was and is a very religious Jewish American who was appalled at Zionism and spoke out fervently against it as representing Judaism, saying it did not, and was in fact the antithesis of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because of this conflation of Judaism with Israel, then one of the things that Zionists do, and they've done it effectively, although I think it's wearing off a bit, is try to say, oh, if you're critical of Israel, you therefore are an anti-Semite, and try to claim that those of us, including Israelis themselves, who are critical of the Israeli government and of Israeli policies, you know, try to term people like that anti-Semitic, which is saying that we are bigots. Well, you know, you can look into my life history, and, you know, I'm not a bigot. I have a life history of opposing bigotry. Many people that are working on this issue, one of the things that I think motivates us is we're against discrimination. We believe that all human beings are human. We deserve respect. Our deaths are tragic when they occur, regardless of the race, religion, or ethnicity, or even the nationality of the human being. You know, when a child is killed, that is a tragedy. And attaching some sort of religious or ethnic label to that death, and therefore saying, well, that's more tragic than some other death, is not something I agree to. I think we're all humans, and this should always matter to all of us. We all need to pursue policies and activities that will bring peace and that will allow all of us around the planet to raise our children in health and safety.
And that really gets to one of the points, of course, is, you know, how do we bring peace in the Middle East?
That's right.
When you're looking at this kind of layered, long-term conflict that is based on something that's at its source a lie, how do you bring that back to the point of peace?
Well, you know, one of the good things is that was a region that was living in largely peacefully for many centuries. you know, often this is portrayed as a long-term conflict between Jews and Muslims and Christians, etc., when in fact it really is. What we see is Zionism started in the late 1800s. Israel was created in 1948. It's a very recent development. Before that time, Jews, Christians, and Muslims were all living in Palestine. In the late 1800s, it was approximately 80% Muslim, about 15% Christian, and about 5% Jewish, all practicing their religions, all living as neighbors. I've interviewed a number of Palestinians that are, you know, older people, and I've asked them, well, before 1948, did you know any Jewish people in your village or in Jerusalem or wherever you lived in Palestine? And they have always said, oh, yes, you know, we knew Jewish people. We had friends that were neighbors. We lent each other money. We helped each other. So there is a history of getting along in that region that I believe and that can be returned to by following probably the South African model of peace and reconciliation committees, of acknowledgement of guilt, of working through that, of acknowledgement of what went on, allowing people to tell their stories, and then moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
I think that a big piece of moving to a peaceful solution is by accurately informing the American public about this issue, because we are playing a role in it, and we don't even know the role we're playing in it, and we certainly don't know the current realities, and very few of us even know the history of it.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things you'd say we absolutely have to have is what you're trying to give us, which is the truth.
That's what I think it's essential.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's essential that for us to know the facts on it. And we need to know the history, too. We need to know what's going on now. We also, many of us, there are many, many myths about Israel. I grew up with them. I certainly, you know, saw Exodus. I remember, you know, we all fell in love with Paul Newman, or many of us
did. Oh, yes, we all did.
And, you know, that was a very moving movie. Many people read the book. Well, it's portraying, what it was portraying, it was actually very inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
We need to go back and find out what really went on in 1947 through 1949, what preceded it, what came after it in the 1950s. We need to learn about the 1967 war, go beyond the myths, again, that most of us have believed about it for many years. We need to know about the truth about 1973 war, about the previous invasions of Lebanon that were extremely, extremely ruthless, in which thousands of civilians were killed, thousands of Palestinian refugees were killed, in which cluster bombs were used that in one day alone caused the amputation of 1,000 people in Beirut. And these are horrific histories. They're not fun to learn about, but, you know, we want peace and we want to move forward where we won't have this kind of atrocities and this kind of tragedy. And to do that, we need to know our facts. And then we need to act in the ways that our particular principles and morality require us to act.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we can do that.
So what we need is, we need justice.
That's right.
For people to move on, they need to feel that they have been heard, they have been understood, and that they have been made whole in any
way that we can make
them whole.
I agree. And it can happen. You know, people, look at our own civil war in this country. You know, that was massive death, massive, you know, tragedy, and at the end, people moved on, and even in the South, where people, you know, certainly slave owners were concerned, well, you know, what will happen when the slaves are freed? Will there be bloodbaths when they kill all of us? Well, it turned out that the slaves then wanted to live their lives. There was a high rate of marriage, of people getting married, a high rate of creating schools in barns, etc. You know, history shows
mm-hmm.
that there have been horrible atrocities, horrible conflicts, and then people have moved on and tried to improve the world,
mm-hmm.
and we all just need to keep doing that.
And it looks to me, from some of the examples that you've actually outlined there, is when people don't have an ability to move on and they don't feel a sense of hope, then mm-hmm. that's when you get the atrocities.
I agree. And I don't think, you know, we want a lasting solution. So, you know, coming up with a peace, an imposed peace, where the powerful body, you know, basically it's like, you know, you have somebody down on the ground and your foot on their neck, and they say, okay, I agree to that. that's not much of a lasting solution. You need a solution where both parties feel, okay, this is basically fair. We're hammering out something that's a compromise that has some justice to it that we can all live with, that has enough fairness within it that we can move on and learn how to live as neighbors.
Mm-hmm. And that really, I mean, you've gotten to know a lot of Palestinians. Wouldn't you say, that most of them, that's what they want? Please just let us, live.
I find that consistently. I've talked to young Palestinian men in Gaza. That's the age group you always know that will be the most fiery in any population. And I talked to them, well, what kind of future could there be? Could you live with Israelis, et cetera? And in the discussions, I felt that they were legitimately and honestly saying that they could and that they wanted to move on with their lives, et cetera. So, I think that there's a lot that needs to be done, and everybody recognizes that, but the first step is to learn about it and then to start acting in ways that will bring that to pass.
So what would you recommend that people do? They should go definitely look at your website, which is ifamericansknew.org, and they should inform themselves about what's happening. But another step they might want to take is to write the stations and write the people who advertise through the stations and insist that this happen. Because we've done everything we can through Congress, and Congress is inert.
That's right. I think we need to educate our communities. We need to call, email, and write the media, our local newspaper or news station. I hope people will read the article I wrote about USA Today and its abysmal coverage of the USS Liberty, and call up USA Today and say, run the correction. You made a mistake. Fix it.
Mm-hmm.
I think... I don't want to just single out USA Today, because at least they wrote something. The New York Times and Washington Post had nothing on the 40th anniversary of the USS Liberty. So people may want to call up the Washington Post or email them or write a letter and say, this was a significant event. Why did you not cover it?
Mm-hmm.
We want coverage. I think as consumers of the news media and as American citizens, we need to let the news media know we want full, accurate, unbiased coverage. We need the facts. We won't need the facts. We want the facts. We demand them.
Mm-hmm. And that could make a difference.
I think it can. In the meantime, we'll become the media ourselves. We'll tell each other, tell our communities. We have a lot of information on our website that people can download, can print out, can order DVDs from us, booklets that have a lot of the facts that we should have written by excellent sources that we've just made into booklets. And we hope people would just become the media. If the media won't do the job, then we have to do it.
Well, and I'm really going to hope, and I know that you do too, that that's what happens. And
that's
I think
right.
that it can. Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
And God bless you for the work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you. And you have a great weekend.
Thanks. You
okay.
too.
Good night.
Goodbye. Take care.
Virtual politician, we root out injustice and those nasty greedy of the grid, those sneak thieves who line our pockets, line their own pockets by stealing our freedom. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That when any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences designed to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom. And may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.